You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. Support for this program comes from the Lannan Foundation, presenting a talk by Vijay Prashad in conversation with Melanie K. Yazzie on Wednesday, September 25th at 7 o'clock at the Lensic in Santa Fe. Vijay Prashad is a Marxist historian and journalist and the author of 25 books, including The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World, and The Poorer Nations, A Possible History of the Global South. He also is the director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, a global movement-driven research institution. Tickets available at the Lensic or lensic.org. On September 23rd and 24th, at the Lensic, the Santa Fe Institute's 2019 ULAM Lecture Series goes to the forefront of infectious disease research. Join epidemiologist Lauren Ansel Myers to learn how scientists use social media and internet search data to save lives, and how the science of networks may help prevent the next pandemic. These two lectures are self-contained and can be enjoyed together or separately. Free tickets are available at ticketsantafe.org. And we're talking today about climate youth, climate activism, and we have here four young people who are New Mexico activists. Ruby Lopez is a student at Santa Fe Community College. Vero Aileen Campos is at the Academy for Technology and the Classics. Yang is a student at New Mexico School for the Arts, and Josue Damian Martinez is a recent graduate of St. Edward's University in Austin, Texas. He's also a hip-hop artist. They're all part of the Sunrise Movement and New Mexico Youth United for Climate Crisis Action, YUCCA, which is part of Earth Care. Welcome, everybody, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
So, YUCCA is a group of youth activists from all over northern New Mexico. How did you all come together?
Bianca, which is one of our main connections, just kind of asked us about it, and she knew we were driven about this, and she pinpointed people who she thought would really help lead this movement and really get the strike happening and going. So she asked all of us, and we agreed.
If we can trace back also a little bit to early June, we had an academy as well with young people. It was a program. Maybe we can speak a little bit more on that. But also, we came together for that program, youth from all over northern New Mexico, all backgrounds. And after that, we decided we wanted to focus on an issue that is very impactful today, and it's going to impact us in the future as well.
I got into Youth Allies Earth Care during my freshman year of high school. I was really intrigued and motivated by the pollution going on my reservation. And so I did a half a year training with Youth Allies Earth Care. And then the other half, we went out and did action.
Which Pueblo are you from?
I'm from the Navajo Nation.
You're from the Navajo Nation?
Yes.
And Ruby, what about you?
So I got started with Earth Care right out of high school, and I was working mostly with them. I still do with this work as an educator in our elementary schools and this year in a couple of the middle schools. But YUCCA kind of came out of a drive to organize around the climate strike. It was actually one of our fellow Earth Care youth leaders that helped to organize the climate strike right after Greta Thunberg had started, what was it, in March? So from then we had this group of people that was already invested in this climate strike in one place, and so YUCCA kind of was born out of that and has been working on organizing around the September 20th call to action since then.
Josue, you were talking a moment ago about this academy. Tell us more about that.
I would say that was a good pinpoint in terms of where a lot of young people sort of came together. But EarthCare has this academy at the beginning of June, where it was a training where we learned a lot about issues within the community, how to organize, how to mobilize. And I would say those are some tools that, for example, EarthCare kind of provided us with to help understanding how to address some of these issues. And I've been a part of Earth Care since 2012. And I went off to college and came back and decided to give back to this community.
You're from here.
I am from here, yeah. Well, I was born in Mexico. I'm a dreamer. And I was brought here at the age of 3, but I've been raised in Santa Fe my entire life. So I do call this place home. But yeah, and the reason for why I just drawn to the academy is because that's where I met a lot of these young people. A lot of these young people who shared this passion and this interest to address this issue. But like Ruby had said, yeah, it's something that has been organized and it's part of a bigger movement, which I think it's important to really recognize that it's not just us. It's happening globally across different countries. And it's a movement that has been inspired by Greta Thunberg.
Yeah, she is quite an amazing young person who, I mean, not only has made headlines, but is really bringing up some very important issues, like why is it that if we're in the middle of a true international emergency that people aren't really doing anything? And I was wondering if each of you could sort of talk about how you realized that we are in actually a state of emergency.
Well, I've always known, kind of. I've always felt that there's something wrong in how we took everything. But now, I mean, it's nice that a lot of people are aware and they're demanding our government to act. But it's been like an ongoing fight kind of all my life.
Yeah.
I've always seen it was never okay that we were just doing too much. But there was that sense that we would eventually get here. And things had to be drastic and escalate quickly for people to pay attention. And it's kind of sad that that's what it takes. But now that a lot of us are aware and that we want to do something, I feel like if we all have that drive, we can make it happen.
What is it that you are all, I mean, there's a lot of actions coming up and we'll be talking about those actions, but what are the real changes that you all would like to see, both in our individual lives, but especially in the level of policy?
I think one thing that I would like to see as an Indigenous person is to have Indigenous voices be on the front lines of their own homelands. It's very systematic and corrupted to see my people not have a voice on their homelands, especially if it's getting polluted and contaminated with all these toxins and chemicals that we cannot take back from the earth and renew. So I think one thing I would like to see is to have the voices of the Indigenous communities and tribal land authorities give the voice to the people who are being heavily impacted.
What are some of the impacts that you're seeing in the Navajo Nation now?
One of the impacts of many that I've seen on the reservations are drastic changes in how the reservation works. I feel like it's a whole different world on the reservation compared to the city. We don't have the right efficient resources such as water, agricultural resources. We don't have any electricity on most of the reservations. And the impacts that the oil companies, oil refineries, and oil barrels are left really create a unsafe space for the people, especially the young people. There's not playgrounds on the reservations, but yet there's oil refineries on the reservations.
Right.
There's not that much adequate sources for these kids to express themselves, which often leads to substance abuse. So in a way, it's a big connection with epidemics connecting together. It's not just one thing happening because of the earth. It's a global thing that's happening.
It seems like in a place where there's insufficient electricity, that solar would be ideal.
Yeah, that would make sense. I read an article last year that I believe it was the Powake or the Picarice Pueblo that were funding solar panels. They had solar panels on their housing authorities, and that money was generated to going back into the community. So there's some changes within the resource, but it needs to expand everywhere and not just one pueblo.
Yeah, I think in addition to that, there are certainly resources, and you can ask yourself, especially in northern New Mexico, where you can have a lot of windmills and just seeing how many days of sun New Mexico gets. There's also a conversation that and something that we are also addressing with our campaign is changing the narrative and stop making it seem as if transitioning to renewable energies is a bad thing, and stop frightening our people who are affected and constantly are working class, who has a difficult time just paying attention to what happens in the news because they're working so much. I think changing that conversation into seeing renewable energies as an opportunity to invest in our future, as well as bringing in more revenue for our state. I mean, I don't want to just look at it like that, because we lose our humanity, right? We start losing our humanity and start looking at it, oh, revenue, money. But there is a problem. And I think that's one thing that I noticed our country doesn't really focus on. And particularly, I noticed this conversation I had in Austin, Texas, right, about climate crisis is very different as to how we have it in New Mexico.
Really? What's the difference?
I would say is the first thing is that indigenous people aren't at the center of it. It's just people in Texas, they don't have a sense or an understanding of how indigenous folks are being affected by it. And the rest of the country doesn't know. As a matter of fact, it's, I would say, a population that has very much been suppressed these years, and has its history has been forgotten. And that's one thing that coming from New Mexico and being close to these individuals, it makes you realize, and going out there, we're not having the conversation how it's impacting these groups and our people as well. And so that's the first thing that I would say. And also going out to Austin, Texas, a lot of the people who are leading the fight, which is no bad at all, but I mean, it's not a lot of people of color who are also affected by displacement, who are also affected because of a lot of their communities are close to shores, and seeing how displaced that they're becoming. And I think those are the conversations that we don't necessarily have. Particularly when I notice a conversation in Austin, Texas, it's all about we do notice a drought, we do notice hurricanes, and we notice this, but what about these other people who are being affected? I think this is what our movement also wants to highlight as well.
Right. One of the things that I think is really important to talk about is the fact that the Green New Deal, which I know that your movements are in support of, puts front and center not only really taking action on climate disruption, but also the environmental justice piece, the social justice, climate, and social inequality. They're all linked. Does one of you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so the Green New Deal does focus on 100% renewable energy through a just transition. And in New Mexico, that's especially important, considering, I mean, we get something like a quarter of all of our annual budget from oil and gas revenues. And so it's important that when we look at a just transition, we're doing things like part of our grit demands, or part of Yucca's demands, is we are looking for the state to fund a just transition study. What is it going to take for us to be able to transition in a way that people aren't losing their jobs, people aren't being affected negatively by something that overall is going to save us, but we need to make sure that we're not sacrificing people along the way. And so through having a just transition study done for the state, and having a just transition fund for individual communities to be able to study how they can do this in their own communities, figure out what solutions are going to work best for individual towns and cities, then that's when we start looking into the right direction of how we're going to be able to transition.
I feel like this link with all these epidemics and social justice problems on behalf of the indigenous people, from the way I've looked at it, was started with the displacement, as the government confined indigenous people to reservations, took them away from their homelands, and took the children away from their homelands and putting them into the assimilation era. And the assimilation era led to the historical trauma that embedded these Native Americans with things that we can't take back, such as the connection with the earth. And with that assimilation process, we lost our culture, we lost our sense of identity. And so now when I look at it, our generation, after all of that historical trauma, has to deal with trying to get our language back, trying to get our culture back, as well as trying to go back to the earth and stand up with the earth in solidarity. So in a way, it's all connected to how the implemented process of everything has gone to the tribal government. So it's really sad to see my people being affected by this when it could be solved with unity, with people coming together and actually getting over that hate and that negativity that we are always embedded in since the establishment of this country. So I feel like it's something that we need to take in our hands and considerations to really understand where we are as a nation and where we are as a people. Because Mother Earth really does need us at this moment. It's not the time to be fighting over money.
Like infighting within, for example, the Navajo Nation or a Pueblo or something like that. So you see like a direct connection between, on the one hand, like taking back your culture, taking back your language, taking back your identity, and on the other hand, a commitment to renewable energy. Like those things are connected.
Yes, those things are very much connected. It's very difficult to see my people not understand where they are, to not understand that they are trashing the earth, that they have lands, but they're not taking care of them. And they're signing over their lands to unhealthy decisions made by companies that visit the reservations often. I live on the reservation where it's surrounded by two oil refineries, one on the east side and one on the west side. And so everywhere you go on the dirt roads of the reservation is oil refineries and oil barrels. But then you look at it and you see there's no libraries, there's not that much school education, there's not that much parks or recreational parks for these kids to focus on. And I think that's what's really, really affecting my people. It's not just one thing. It's how things all led up to this.
This is a story we have almost everywhere. You know, extraction of resources, but the money and the benefits don't go back to the areas that you're extracting from. Whether it's, you know, the Navajo Nation or some community in Wyoming or Nigeria, basically.
Yes, it's very unjust. Very unjust. I've seen a lot of cases where indigenous sacred homelands are being sold to foreign companies. And it's sad to see that displacement between spiritual connection and greed.
Yeah.
Because it's really getting overpowered. Greed is really getting overpowered by spiritual connection and just moral ethics in general. People are on the reservation, specifically the people on the reservation. I always hear the rivalry between this tribe and that tribe, this tribe and that tribe, over money and land. Money and land. And that's crazy because we can't take either one of those sources when we pass away. So why are we fighting in this life when we can work together and help each other out with getting better efficient water sources, getting better efficient agricultural tools, resources? There's so many things that our people can work towards, but it's just something's holding us back, something's setting us back. And I just wish to see some change possible with these new laws and these new implements that we are finally taking. And it's crazy to see all these problems connect together. And it's sad. It's really sad.
One of the things that you all are kind of referring to when you talk about just transition is making an economic transition that is fair. Because, I mean, if we were to stop drilling immediately tomorrow, that would be the best possible thing for the earth. It would also lead to a lot of chaos. So a transition has to make sense. And one of the things, and as I think you, Ruby, referred to, is that so much of our annual budget in the state of New Mexico comes from oil and gas, and it comes from very specific things like real estate taxes and royalties and severance taxes and things like that. Do you know if there has been any work in trying to figure out how to get those revenues from renewable energy as opposed to oil and gas?
I think that that's kind of where we're coming from and asking for a just transition study fund. There does need to be intensive work to see how these can be viable options, because there's no reason that we can't have things like community solar grids instead of these monopolies on power like we see now, where PNM is powering almost the entire state. There's no reason that we can't have things like community solar grids that are owned by cities, and we have them be just public utilities in the same way that we have water or trash collection.
Right. So then it's sort of like a localized and decentralized energy grid to some extent, which has some real advantages, although not to PNM.
Yeah, and there are already places where this is being done, and it's incredibly beneficial. We would be creating our own energy, which we could sell back to electric companies at some point if that became something that we were creating enough energy to do. And it wouldn't be something that is making a bunch of money for one particular group that then has to pay taxes to benefit the state. It would just be a direct public service.
Have you all been involved in talking to your legislators? Is that something you do when the legislature is in session?
Well, the most recent event I can draw back to is the school board did recently pass a resolution to bring this issue up to our legislatures who are in higher positions. And so, I mean, that's one example of starting. It's a really good example of starting local, right? And getting those people who really represent us. And the school board was the first spot that we've hit. And so that resolution did pass, I believe it was last week.
That's as local as it gets, starting
yeah,
with your school board.
Yeah, as local as it gets. And so after that, it's in terms of moving forward and talking to legislatures, since all this planning and this strike did kind of start this year. And even then, there's movements that have been back, minor things that we've tried to, in order to address this issue, there are minor things that we've done. For example, when I was in Earth Care, between 2013-14, there were young kids that came from elementary schools and said, let's get rid of plastic bags because it's just hard to decompose. And so these young kids came and we supported. Earth Care was behind it as well. Older and younger generations came and said, let's do this. And the city listened and they banned. And obviously, I think there are tweaks and things that we can improve within that legislation. But that's just an example of when young people come together and we go and make our voices loud and together do it. It's very much possible.
Yeah, there's kind of like a moral imperative when a lot of young people show up at these things. You're talking to youth, you're talking to the next generation, you can't ignore them. Even though when you're young, in some ways you feel powerless because you don't even have the vote yet a lot of the time. Talk about the upcoming general climate strike and 7 days of resistance. The strike is on Friday, September 20th, and then the 7 days are the week following that. What's it all about?
So on September 20th, we are hosting a strike happening from 11:30 to 1:30, and it's going to be at the Roundhouse, the state capitol in Santa Fe.
So everyone leaves school.
So everybody leaves school, everybody leaves work. For work, we're asking that the workers leave during their lunch to participate in the walkout. For the students, we're asking them to take a field trip to walk out with their class to demand crisis action. And then the week of disruption is going to be followed by an art show, youth art show called In Crisis, as well as a fracking tour of frontline communities.
So literally a fracking tour, like people getting in buses and going out to see some of these gas lands?
As I understand, yes, at the Eastern Agency. And they are going to be doing rallies and actions at congressional offices and other political parties, as well as special worship services, and as well as teach-ins and events at partner organizations, schools, and businesses. And on the 27th, there is going to be a campaign demands in partnership with the Albuquerque Youth. And on September 27th in Española, there is going to be a closing performance. If you would like some more information, you can go to www.climatestrikenm.org.
climatestrikenm.org. So what is your connection like with other activists from other parts of the state, other states, the rest of the country, and even internationally?
Well, we did a radio show with some of two of the girls from the Albuquerque march and strike, and we're trying to really connect and see if there's any way that we can kind of incorporate and just involve all of our community.
Mm-hmm.
We've also been doing some work with a really awesome young lady from Española that has been mobilizing her community. We have been working some with youth out in the Las Vegas area and also students at the United World College, which includes students from all over the world. And so we'll really have a truly multicultural event on the 20th because students from the UWC are planning on attending.
Yeah, UWC, they've got students from, like, I don't know, 50 or 100 different countries. It's an amazing place. I think one of the things that's so tricky with this stuff is that young people see that adults have basically, you know, are in the process of robbing them of their future. And adults are going, oh, sorry, what? You know, not really paying attention. I mean, kids get it, right? I mean, everybody gets it. Do you know any young people who are kind of blasé about this, or is everybody pretty much activated?
Well, I went to New York this summer. Well, actually, it was Washington this summer. I went to the American Civil Liberties Union Advocacy Institute, and it was a week-long training that we did in Washington, D.C., with 900 other activists in America. And we went out and we rallied for the last day in the state capitol. And it was really amazing to see that there was this one girl who was asking her mom questions about these kids in the streets wearing bright yellow shirts and signs and yelling. And she asked her mom, why are they yelling? Why are they being so loud? And she was probably about, I would say, 4 years old. And her mom tried to explain to her what our process of being there was, what we were protesting about, what we were yelling about, in the sense. And so this lady came up and walked up to us and told us that her daughter was curious about why we were out here. And her mother tried to explain to her that there's not people that are listening to young people, so they have to be loud to get their way, specifically. That little girl responded, why are they out here yelling when they know they can't get their way? And so this really opened my mind that kids are aware. Kids do know what's going on. Kids are more mature and more knowledgeable because of the technology resource that they have. They can easily just look up on the phone anything that's going on in the world right now. And so I think just that little girl was an example as to this is history, and we are in a crucial time in human history that we do need to create change. We do need to be loud, even if we don't get understood, even if we don't get what we want. So I think that was one really, really powerful thing that woke me up to the little young ones.
I think that education is such a big part of this. And obviously it depends on what household you live in. Some parents don't really care, or they're just not aware. And there's, to be honest, a lot of this stuff you don't see or hear at school unless you're like driven or you have groups. I'm part of like a green team at my school, but some schools don't have those resources. And I don't know, some people just underestimate themselves. And they're just like, I could never do that, or how would it such a single and just such a small club can really impact and do a change, and how can I be part of this? But it really all matters, and that's what the youth, like you were saying, the youth tend to do is belittle themselves and just say, oh, this is insignificant, I can't vote. But obviously you can convince your parents to educate them about who is running and what they're for and how important it is to have a future. Because obviously I've always been driven by this, but I see a lot of youth just angry at this point, because I've always felt that I didn't have a voice in this. And that's because kind of like the culture I grew up with, and where my household is just that if you're not this big person, you're not this celebrity, this politician, you can't really have a say or really be part of something big. But it's completely not true, and that's what we have to start teaching everybody. Kids, I'm going to teach my nephews this and tell them that their voice matters, and whatever they think is the right thing to do to push for it. My nephew's, what, like 5? And he already knows there's something wrong, and he wants to recycle every little thing. And it's such, that drive that I see in him is just so like empowering. It just boosts me, I guess. And just to see that, to see that he doesn't know much about this, but if he did, to see what his ability can take him to. And that's why I think education is such an important thing.
Do you see a lot of young people educating their parents? I'm seeing nods all around.
Yeah, I try to do that with my parents. Kind of with the small things, the household things. Oh, don't use like for example, don't use plastic toothbrushes, or don't do this, or don't grab the plastic bags at the store, just take your own.
or buy in bulk and just stuff like that. I try to, well, I kind of force them to do this stuff.
Right.
Because that's kind of, I guess, the easiest way to start, to make those little changes. And from there, you can just take it. Oh, I heard this. And they can vote. So obviously, I push them like, oh, she knows what she's doing. She knows what needs to happen. And just try to convince them to be heard through their vote.
Yeah, I've always felt like it was such a ironic thing to see my mom educate me about my culture and my stance in the earth since a kid. And now it's weird because it switched around, where I'm educating her about where I stand in this earth and how we all stand in this earth. And so she's always, she's a really good supporter, but then she's also afraid of the world and how the world react to me for me speaking out and educating other people. So I feel like I am educating my parents on this aspect as well as my family, but also it's putting me in a threat to say this, to speak the truth.
Do you feel like that, or does your mom feel like that, or some of both?
I think it's both. It's both, but mostly her, because she sees the world and how wicked it is, but I don't. I see the world as more than that. It's more than just wicked and evil. And so I think it's time for me to stand up to this wicked and evil, because this is kind of something that I was destined for. You know, especially in my family, I'll be the first generation to graduate. And so from that, just that sentence, that literally shows you that I'm the first one to do something in my family and to lead my family in the right path. And so I think educating them on sustainability is really important, but also it's also not a choice to not stand up for it.
Right.
I think in my household, it's tough, especially I think, well, I'm an immigrant myself and my parents are immigrants, and to keep them, one thing that I realized just growing up is that my brothers and I, for my parents, have been the only way to keep them updated with pop culture, with American culture, with America and how just America is in general. We're kind of like, especially me, was kind of like that test dummy where you go out and you consume all this culture, you consume a whole new country, and for them, if it wasn't for us, they wouldn't know what's going on in the world. And that's the reality with a lot of kids who particularly live in the south side of Santa Fe, which I notice are the ones to be less involved, because I think there's just so much that they have to keep up with and let their parents know, with issues of immigration, with issues of police brutality, with issues. I think there's just so much that distracts them from having to focus on climate change, for example, because it's not something that directly impacts us. Like, people like us are worried about if we're going to see our parents a week and home the next day. We can't really worry about the ice is melting in the Atlantic. Like, why does that even matter to me? And I think that's really tough fight that I've been having to fight with the young people. And I myself have been having to fight with my parents in terms of, we need to pay attention to this too. Like, I know there's just so much that we already encounter and face in our lives daily, but there's also this other issue. And I think it puts even more pressure on those types of communities. It's just, aside from already facing the issues that we face, we have to worry about whether we're going to be under the ocean in the next couple of years. Like, there's just so much. And I think that's one tough battle to really fight. And I noticed that my brothers and I are constantly fighting that battle of, even in my music, like, there's just so much that I can address. And I try to tell the story of my immigrant community and my Latinx community through music. And I noticed that hip hop is a way to reach to these students, to tell them and make them more aware of these issues, which is why I also write about things that happen to our earth within my music, because I think it's a good way to keep them engaged and keep them connected. Because even though I can't have them show up at our meetings, I can at least have them listen to a song of mine that will educate them and help them kind of be more aware and try to do something within their household that they can do. But I think it's a tough fight, I think, especially.
Is there a lot of that these days? Like, you know, in a generation or two ago, it was protest songs that were sort of like folk music on the guitar. Is it now like protest songs are in hip hop and other genres like that?
Yeah, I think for a while within like early 2000s, I think music was kind of weird, right? It didn't really, for me at least, it wasn't like a lot of advocating for issues after like the 90s movement and the 80s, like early good hip hop. And now I think today, 21st century, there's a lot more hip hop artists aware of different issues. I will say that when I listen to the artists that I listen to, they're not talking about climate crisis, but it's not their fault because they're talking about other issues that are really addressing or impacting their communities. And I think for this particular issue, there's not such a big movement within our pop culture. There isn't. I mean, the one song that I can think of, an artist called Lil Dicky, put out a song called Earth. I don't know if anyone has listened to it. It's just a very interesting song. And I think that's been the only time that I heard a big artist or like this try to address this issue. But even then, the artist doesn't address issues such as displacement, like how it affects indigenous folks, how it affects, there's none of that. It's more about, we love our earth, this is our planet, let's defend it. That's kind of like all the lyrics it says. And I think
right.
There are definitely movements, I think today in particular, more visible just because of how our culture has changed and how much aware we are of different issues. But I will say that hip hop is still, in our pop culture, is a good way to reach out to young people.
I mean, I think this is the big problem, is that, you know, we evolved to be afraid of immediate threats, whether it was a saber-toothed tiger or a weather event or something like that. And the contemporary version of those things are police coming after you or ICE or something like that, which are immediate, terrifying threats. Whereas something that is relatively slow moving is harder to wrap your head around. And it's easier to put off until tomorrow.
Yeah, of course.
How I see is that we tend to look at the future and, oh, we need to do this and that. And we want to have, like, a clean environment and all that stuff. But we just tend to forget about the now. And like how he said, we're thinking about things that are more, I guess, more important in our at the moment. And why I, like, see this a lot is because my mom just constantly lives in fear. Like Yang, she doesn't really want me to be doing this stuff because, like, risking arrest or just being a target, if that makes sense.
Right.
That's just her mind. It's just, it takes it a step farther.
And we have to love our parents, and yeah. Many of them are like that.
Yeah. I completely understand her, but I just, my answer to that is I'm just done living in fear.
Yeah.
And just, oh, tomorrow, we never know if we have it tomorrow. For all we know, it the 12 years goes down to 10 to 2. So it's just, we can't be putting it off, and we can't continue to be living in fear.
The 12 years that, in theory, we have left.
Yeah.
Now, notice how in 2006 they were saying we have 10 years. And then in 2012 they were saying we have 10 years. They keep saying we have 10 years,
yeah.
Or 12 years. Who knows?
Yeah, but there's just stuff happening. The Amazon is burning. Greenland is
right.
Melting.
Right.
And obviously, if it's baffling to scientists, there's something really wrong here.
Right.
I feel like there needs to be more coverage, like Josue said, that this is something that's been going on, and to just finally address it, because it is in the attention, but we need to put action to it.
Yeah, and to kind of piggyback off of the whole, oh, the sky has always been falling. Well, unfortunately, even if we did stop drilling today, even if we stopped, you know, producing more plastics and figured out how to transition today, I mean, we've already lost thousands of species. We've lost the ability to take so much carbon out of the air. We're already going to be seeing these effects for the rest of our lifetimes. When we say we're fighting for a future, at this point we're not fighting for a future that's the norm. We're fighting for something that we can survive. It was in 2006 or whatever, oh, we have 10 years. We have 10 years to stop it from rising the way that it is, to avoid any effects. We ignored that warning, and then we've been seeing things like Category 5 hurricanes is the norm rather than something shocking.
Right.
And, you know, things like our droughts or our growing seasons. Not this past growing season, but last year, June, we did not get a single rain the entire time, that such that by the time, you know, any of our fruit trees got water, they were so dehydrated, but they were doing what they're supposed to, and they grew fruit, and the fruit got so big for the weakened branches that
in my experience, several trees lost their branches because they just couldn't support the fruit anymore. Things aren't growing the way that they were before. We can't predict the way our food is going to be able to be produced regularly. You know, we're going to be seeing things like rising prices on fresh produce. We're going to be seeing things like there's no vegetables or fruit in, unfortunately, it's going to hit low-income communities first.
Right.
Because once it's hard to find these basic things that we need to survive, we're just going to raise the prices on them.
Now, you were saying that there's a lot of young people who are angry. What does it take to convert that anger into action?
Well, I think it's also important to remember that people aren't only angry. This is one of the most disenfranchised generations. We are graduating with crippling debt that make it impossible to do things like dedicate time to the climate crisis and dedicate time to things that we are passionate about. Because I know, for just in my example, I work 3 jobs. You know, by the end of the day, I have a granola bar for dinner because that's what I have time for. And that's unfortunately the norm for people my age. And it's unfortunately considered just what happens now. And so by the end of the week, we don't have time or energy to be putting into things like these actions, which we're still doing it because if we don't, then we're really screwed.
Right. Another part of this conversation, which we don't have to go into in great detail, but is the fact of, just exactly as you're saying, economic inequality being part of this, because what happens when you move a huge amount of wealth from the working and middle classes to the top so that all the rest of us are disenfranchised in one way or another, it's very hard to do a lot of things, including have the time to really make your voices heard, because as you say, people are working so many jobs and doing so much just to survive from day to day that it's hard to see the big picture. So part of the response to that, and I think it's in the Green New Deal, is kind of spreading the wealth a little bit more, or a lot more evenly. Okay, so September 20th is the big climate strike, and people can find more about that at climatestrikenm.org. There's a list on that website. There's a list of demands.
Yeah.
Tell us about those.
So our number one demand is that we're declaring a climate emergency and that we need the government to acknowledge this and take action accordingly. And the second one is that we want New Mexico to have a plan to be carbon neutral no later than 2030. And our third one is that, how we mentioned multiple times, we just want a just transition fund and we need a study to see how to end our dependence on fossil fuel. Because how Ruby said, we are very dependent on fossil fuel money and it basically pays for education.
Right, right. Anything else that you want people to know before we go? And especially about engaging adults. I mean, youth gets it. I think a lot of adults get it too, but what's the next step for them to engage and to support you guys?
So, of course, coming out on September 20th is going to be huge. Just having bodies there, having numbers, is very important. If you're interested in helping with that, coming to a planning meeting, our last one is actually this next Saturday from 12:30 to 2:30.
That's the 14th of September.
Mm-hmm. Signing on to our mailing list, which you can find information to do at climatestrikenm.org. Helping share our mailing list, helping share information about us on social media. If you're an artist or a visual artist or a performer, then getting in touch if you want to share some of your art. We're looking to center youth voices in this and people most directly affected by the climate crisis. And donating. It doesn't come cheap. We need things like walkie-talkies. We need things like just snacks at these meetings.
Right.
One thing I would like to say is that we are in a climate emergency and we need to take action as soon as possible. It's not a time to set it off for tomorrow, but it's also not a time to set it off for yesterday. So I feel like it's very important that the youth get out and start exercising their rights, especially since it's going to be our leaders in offices that are going to make these actions and make these decisions. So I feel like if there's youth out there that feel like they can't get involved, they don't know how to get involved, then just start doing your research. Start educating yourself, because an educated person is a dangerous person in the society. They could create change and they could implement motivation for people. So I feel like take action and just believe in yourself that anything is possible.
Before we go, Josue Damian Martinez, how can people access your music?
Yeah, you could go to creative-jay.com. That's creativej.com, creative-jay.com. You'll find everything you
and
need
that's
to
you?
Find there. Yeah,
okay.
That's me. That's my stage name. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank you all so much for being with us, Ruby Lopez, Veroilin Campos Young, and Josue Damian Martinez. Thank you for being with us on the Radio Cafe, and we will link on radiocafe.org to climatestrikenm.org. Once again, September 20th and the week to follow. Lots going on. Thank you all so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And many thanks to our sponsors, the Lanel Foundation, the Lannan Foundation, and the Santa Fe Institute. Thank you so much for your support of the Radio Cafe. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Funding learning initiatives and community programs, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanel Foundation for support of the Radio Cafe. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.